Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rachel Long, the current president, who slid in here right at 10 o'clock. Not quite slid, but there was definitely some sliding on the way from my place. So. Prairie is a lay-led society with Minister Ralph Tiksinski, and we have a variety of presenters, both lay-led from our own community and also from the wider community, and also about once a month our Minister Ralph Tiksinski presents to us. We aspire to be an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation, and we welcome everyone, no matter what your religious or ethnic background, no matter what your age, your abilities or your inabilities, your sexual orientation or your family structure. We hope you feel welcome here. Toward the end of the service, we will have a time for guests and visitors to introduce themselves, no matter how young. And we hope that you feel comfortable introducing yourself to us at that time. Our opening words today will be read by Robin Proud, and it's a responsive reading, number 592 in your Singing the Living tradition. And this is by William Ellery Channing, and you'll see a rather young picture of Channing on the center right. Oh, no, that's all right. I call that mind free, which masters the senses and which recognizes its own reality and greatness. I call that mind free which jealously guards its intellectual rights and powers, which does not content itself with a passive or hereditary faith.
Which opens itself to life whensoever it may come, which receives new truth as an angel from heaven.
I call that mind free which is not passively framed by outward circumstances and is not the creature of accidental impulse.
Which discovers everywhere.
I call that mind free which protects itself against the usurpations of society and which does not cower to human opinion. I call that mind free which resists the bondage of habit, which does not mechanically copy the past nor live on its old virtues. I call that mind free which sets no bounds to its love, which wherever they are seen delights in virtue and sympathizes with suffering.
Which recognizes in all human beings the image of God and the rights of God's children and offers itself up on a willing sacrifice to the cause of humankind.
I call that mind free which has cast off all fear but that of wrongdoing and which no menace or peril can enthrall. And now we will light the chalice and have a moment of meditation.
It's hard to find that silence sometimes in yourself. And sometimes when I hear the young ones who have a harder time than we do, I think, well, they're just saying what's going on in my head. Our first hymn will be hymn 44, we sing of golden mornings. As a caring community, we now have time to share joys or concerns briefly with our neighbors and community. And please wait for the microphone. Susan has one in the back. Anyone? Anne?
What a joy. Rose Smith is 81 today.
Happy birthday.
That means that Galen and I are the same age for 2 months and he can't boss me around.
Oh, I got to change pace. Spring, that one of the songs we just sang, spring is on the way. The great horned owls in our neighborhood are hooting away. And they're probably sitting on their eggs now, maybe about to hatch. So for them, it is spring.
Well, it was a joy to see a lot of you last week at the little memorial party for Rachel Siegfried, who died on January 2nd. And it was really, really a nice time. We gathered at her house over in Tolman Terrace, which is out that way, a little ways. And all of her children were there, and we sang some of her favorite songs, and we told lots of stories about Rachel, who was a wonderful person and who will be missed greatly.
Pat.
Yeah, Anne just reminded me, which I'm glad she did. There was no obituary in the newspaper for Rachel, and there's not going to be. But when we were at her house, the family had a flyer that they gave everyone, which is sort of like an obituary. And I brought it in, and I'll post it on the bulletin.
Thank you.
It is in the new
newsletter and on the greeting table. But I still would appreciate it if you'd post it. Thanks. Anyone else? We had a circle dinner at our home last night. We have our circle this year is the families of the teenage kids. And it was a real delight to have Seth and his younger brother Sam and his dad Kurt back in our circle. They've joined us, and so we haven't seen Kurt around for several months, and we're just thrilled to have him back. Maybe you'll have a chance to introduce yourself later on. But it's so much fun to see those teens together playing. You know, I think yesterday it was Munchkin and card games, and just hearing that peals of laughter from the basement was great. So, anyone else? Okay. I get the joy of introducing our own Robin Proud, who most of you know pretty well by now from her various performances. Behind every great man, the Peabody Sisters, and I'll let you go ahead and introduce.
Good morning. I thought I'd introduce our cast of characters a bit first that I have up here. The first hymn was chosen not so much to evoke spring, although we might want to do that, but because the words were written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. In the center here, we do have the three Peabody sisters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Sophia. Now, they were mainly before the age of photography, although this, I'm sure, was taken later in life. It may not be the best likeness of Elizabeth, but it's the only one I could find. Now, it seemed to me that she looked like she was separated at birth from Andy Summers.
So.
If we ever need to cast that part. But she did live to be 90 years old, and I think this was taken later in her life when she was very active in the kindergarten movement. Mary was known as the beauty of the family. I don't know that this picture does her justice either. Sophia was the one who actually has her portrait here painted by a famous painter of the time. Then we have some of the other figures. Bronson Alcott, who you probably know as a Unitarian and through his daughter Louisa May Alcott. Horace Mann, who married Mary. And I think that we could cast Galen for this one. William Ellery Channing, very famous Unitarian minister. Theodore Parker, also a Unitarian minister. Nathaniel Hawthorne, I'm sure many of you read The Scarlet Letter in high school with great enjoyment. He and Sophia were married. We do have Emerson down here and Margaret Fuller, who were part of this circle as well. And here, these are smaller, but you can look at these. They did not have wedding photographers at the time, but apparently something they did was to make silhouettes of the couple. So this is a silhouette of Nathaniel Hawthorne and Sophia Peabody on their wedding day, and this is Mary Peabody and Horace Mann on their wedding day. I've entitled my talk, Behind Every Great Man, after a classic saying with that beginning, and it's been filled in different ways. Behind every great man is a great woman, or is a woman pushing and shoving. And supposedly Hubert Humphrey said, behind every great man is a surprised mother-in-law. But it was literally true for many of the major figures of 19th century New England in philosophy, politics, religion, and literature. They worked up and polished their ideas in conjunction with the women in their lives, although we rarely hear about the women. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a champion of self-reliance, had not only his devoted and domestic wife, Lydian, but numerous acolytes who gathered at his home. In descriptions that I've read, Emerson resembles to me a radical professor surrounded by his adoring graduate students. And of these, the most assiduous were women, Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody. But Emerson wasn't the only one to benefit. The Peabody sisters, Elizabeth, Mary, and Sophia, served as teachers, translators, scribes, discussion partners, promoters, and publishers for a glorious pantheon of writers and artists and public figures. For example, Sophia illustrated stories by Nathaniel Hawthorne. The sisters introduced him into the Transcendentalist circle, and finally Sophia married him. Mary married Horace Mann, and with her sisters, inspired him to devote his life to the improvement of public education, for which he is still famous. He did not have a particular interest in education until he met the Peabody sisters. Elizabeth was an intimate of all these famous folks up here. She never married, and she's best known today for her successful effort to establish public kindergartens in the United States. The sisters all agreed that the highest mission in a woman's life was to help and support great men. In spite of their unquestioned intelligence, industry, and inspiration, these women, in keeping with the culture of their time, never aspired to promote or advance themselves. And here they differed with Margaret Fuller, who was quite willing to be famous in her own right. Most of the information that I'm going to share with you today comes from an excellent book, The Peabody Sisters, Three Women Who Ignited American Romanticism. This was written by Megan Marshall in 2005 and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It's fascinating, has a lot of detail on their lives and their circle, some photographs and illustrations and a lot of excerpts from their diaries and journals. Ms. Marshall spent almost 20 years discovering and reading hundreds of original documents on the sisters and all the people in their lives. She undertook to read everything that they had written, everything written about them, and many of the books that they would have read as well. Because they interacted with so many famous people, a good amount of their correspondence has been preserved. In fact, sometimes it's possible to see the same event or conversation recounted by various people. The contrast between the more official documents and their personal letters and journals is fascinating. It reminded me of a TV reality show where the participant gets a chance to approach the camera and reveal her innermost feelings about what has just transpired. For example, in writing to the gentleman they admired, the sisters were always formal and circuitous. We would think very vague. But then, in their private moments, in their letters and journals, they sometimes revealed their real passions, fears, and jealousies. I think there's a temptation for us to consider that people who lived in technologically simpler times led lives that were less emotionally complicated. But of course, human beings are the same in all eras. Elizabeth was the one to first befriend both Mann and Hawthorne, to the point that other people thought there was an understanding between them. But then, after each man fixed his interest on one of her younger sisters, Elizabeth denied that she had ever had a romantic interest in them. What I'm going to give you today is just a brief introduction to the sisters' lives, and especially Elizabeth's, and focus on some of the great men that they knew. For further details, I do highly recommend this book, which not only has a great wealth of detail, but also explodes some of the myths that had grown up around them. As I've researched several 19th century women, I've found that after their deaths, their friends and families tended to downplay the radical and powerful aspects of their characters, making them seem more domestic and less threatening to the status quo. To understand the sisters, we need to have at least an acquaintance with their mother, Eliza Palmer Peabody. She was a formidable figure in her own right. A child of the American Revolution, whose father frightened her mother by coming home in war paint and feathers from the Boston Tea Party, Eliza came from an educated and socially established family. But when she married Nathaniel Peabody, the son of an illiterate farmer raised in the backwoods, she doomed herself to a life of financial hardship. Her teaching was often what supported the family and later the work of her daughters. In fact, the Peabody family reminded me of an episode of The Simpsons. It's true. The Simpsons has a reference to everything. In this episode, Lisa is afraid to grow up because she fears she will turn into an adult like her father. Then she finds out that although all the Simpson men are ineffective, immature losers, the Simpson women are uniformly smart, capable, and successful. This was the Peabody family to a T. The three daughters, who had no access to formal higher education, taught themselves or arranged for tutors in languages, philosophy, theology, music, and art. Elizabeth read at least 9 languages and translated numerous works for publication. Sophia was an accomplished artist and sculptor. For most of their lives, the sisters supported their family by their teaching, writing, and small business efforts. On the other hand, their father practiced medicine and dentistry, which at that time did not require university degrees and were not necessarily held in very high esteem. He was never able to establish a successful practice, and he and his sons also failed at several business attempts. The sisters scrimped to send one of their younger brothers, Wellington, to Harvard, where, of course, they could never be admitted. It turned out he spent his time there drinking and gambling and was forced to withdraw. The family sent him off on a whaling ship to learn discipline, but he jumped ship in South America and returned penniless. Another brother, Nat, not only depended on his sisters to help him through business failures and the expenses of an early marriage and family, but then he actively derided the education of women and refused it to his own daughters. So this was the milieu in which these sisters accomplished their amazing endeavors. In the period of 1800 to 1840, the family moved a number of times around the area of Salem, Concord, and Boston, Massachusetts, mainly driven by possible economic opportunities. As young as 16, Elizabeth was already a teacher helping to support her family. The family was always Unitarian, although the sisters sympathized with the efforts of Emerson and Channing to personalize and open up the traditional Unitarian church. In fact, it seems that Elizabeth introduced to those great men some of the concepts which made them famous. So I'm going to talk about several of those men as an introduction to the lives of the sisters. First one is William Ellery Channing. Elizabeth first heard him speak when she was 7 years old. She wrote that she was thrilled as never before to see him communing with God face to face when he was reciting a prayer. His attitude reminded her of her childhood vision of a benignant God, which parents and teachers had tried to replace with a stern Calvinist figure, and Elizabeth never felt comfortable with that. At the age of 13, Elizabeth first had a conversation with Channing, who found her charming and intelligent. And Marshall writes, "If Elizabeth had outlined her past several years reading, Channing would have been even more astonished. All on her own, and by the age of 13, she had followed a good portion of the course of study he recommended for his graduate students in divinity at Harvard." In 1825, when Elizabeth was 21, she finally had the opportunity to attend weekly service at Channing's Federal Street Church in Boston and to become an intimate of the Channing family. She would often visit on Saturday afternoons to discuss the British Romantic poets. Channing introduced her to Wordsworth and Coleridge, whom she admired. And they also talked about the radical concept that these poets had of God as an idea originating in man. At this time, Elizabeth wrote her own translation. She called it a free paraphrase of the Gospel of John. She interpreted the word was made flesh to mean that truth speaking was a divine gift to man, empowering each individual to search for meaning in life. Channing applauded what he called these original thoughts, although he was not ready himself to take on such a heretical position. And already at this time, Elizabeth used a word she got from Coleridge, transcendental, to describe her philosophy, transcendentalism. During the same time, Elizabeth was holding Saturday morning discussion classes for young ladies. She would share these topics with Reverend Channing at the Saturday midday dinner. And only years later, in reading over her diary of the time, did she see that, quote, "In every instance, the subject of composition I chose for my class on Saturday proved to be the subject of Dr. Channing's sermon the next day." Even at that later date, she never claimed that she had any influence on Channing, only that perhaps she had been a participant in his own self-education. It was Elizabeth who urged Channing to publish some of his sermons. He claimed he didn't have the time or strength to do all the copying. His health was always uncertain. But Elizabeth volunteered to do the work. In fact, she was so good at it, she was able to copy those quickly and accurately while he was reading to her from completely different philosophical works. Elizabeth eventually copied more than 50 of Channing's sermons. And if they were incomplete, she was often able to supply from memory sections that were left out. These sermons were among the first examples of so-called literary sermons. That is, they were closer to personal essays than the tradition of biblical homilies that was more common at the time. Elizabeth had learned from her mother, who was a lifelong teacher, a belief in child-centered education, delivered with kindness and encouragement, leading the children to develop their own understanding. This was in direct contrast to the traditional methods of the time, which relied on rote memorization and liberal use of the stick. Therefore, Elizabeth was very intrigued by the similar educational theories of a neighbor and acquaintance of their family, Bronson Alcott. She called on a number of families in Boston in order to enroll students for his new school, and she then provided the instruction in Latin, arithmetic, and geography, which were some areas where Alcott was weak. Again, she was very satisfied with promoting a great man rather than setting up her own school. Alcott praised Elizabeth as the most magnificent philosophic imagination of any person he ever knew. They opened the Temple School, named for its setting in the Masonic Temple facing Boston Common, in 1834. Elizabeth, who now boarded with the Alcotts, began to record Bronson's dialogues, as he called them, with his students for publication, showing them to another acquaintance, Emerson, who read them, he said, with greatest pleasure. She published this book, Record of a School, in 1835. Once again, she played the role of recorder for a man, which allowed her to promote the book without making herself the center of attention. Elizabeth was so close to Bronson and his wife, Abby, that when their third daughter was born that year, the younger sister of Anna and Louisa May Alcott, who would one day be famous as Beth in Little Women, was actually named Elizabeth Peabody Alcott. Unfortunately, several incidents interrupted this mutual admiration society. Elizabeth found that she did not always agree with Alcott's practices, such as tempting a child to break rules and then punishing him with isolation. Then there was a new volume, Conversations with Children on the Gospels, over which Alcott wanted more control, and in which he insisted on including his lessons on human sexuality. Although they seemed to us very innocent and vague, at the time this was totally scandalous. Elizabeth tried to persuade him not to distract from his important overall message by shocking the community, but he claimed that that would not be honest. And at the same time, there was a disturbing personal incident. Mrs. Alcott went into Elizabeth's room and read letters from Elizabeth's sister Mary. The letters alluded to Horace Mann, who was another acquaintance, and at that time was an object of affection on the part of both sisters. From what they read, from what Mrs. Alcott read, she accused Elizabeth of criticizing the Alcotts to her friends. This seems like something that would have happened to us during college years. Your roommate came in and read a letter, and someone was saying something about what they told their boyfriend that something. Well, they were still quite young. Elizabeth left the next day. She left the Alcott's home and the school and was replaced by Margaret Fuller. And Abby Alcott crossed out her one-year-old daughter's middle name, transforming her to Elizabeth Sewell Alcott. Interestingly, Elizabeth continued to publicly defend Alcott's educational theories and accomplishments. A few years earlier, as part of her education, Elizabeth had engaged to learn Latin, and through an acquaintance, she had hired his cousin to be her tutor. That tutor was a 19-year-old Ralph Waldo Emerson. At that time, both future transcendentalists were a bit intimidated, and their conversation never strayed from the translations Elizabeth was undertaking. It was through Alcott that Elizabeth re-entered Emerson's circle several years later. In fact, after leaving the Temple School, she went for an extended stay to the home of Waldo, as his friends called him, and his wife Lydia and their infant son, and she made several extended visits of sometimes months at a time. This was a time when Emerson had already resigned from Boston's Second Church in order to pursue a career as an independent writer and speaker. In the summer of 1837, Emerson gave the Phi Beta Kappa oration at Harvard's commencement. In this talk, called The American Scholar, Emerson said to the assembled elites, "I embrace the common." And he praised man's instincts over his education. This wasn't what the elites of Harvard expected to hear. And in 1838, Emerson delivered an even more shocking speech, the Divinity School address. He advocated a religion too large to be confined to Christianity. In this, he drew on discussions he had had with various intimates, including Elizabeth, and from German writers Elizabeth had introduced him to. Although Elizabeth herself never went so far as to drop Christ from Christianity, she saw him as a great human model for others to follow. But once again, Elizabeth was a promoter and defender of men. She wrote several articles in 1839 defending Emerson, although no one would publish them. It was the inspiration of Emerson as the center of lively discussions that led Elizabeth to a new business venture. She decided to open a bookstore and circulating library, specializing in books and journals from Europe that had inspired transcendentalism. This bookshop would also provide a space for the transcendentalists to meet, and for Margaret Fuller to hold her series of conversations for women, based on the earlier meetings Elizabeth herself had held years before. It was a new venture for a woman to run this kind of business. Reverend Channing had to reassure her that there was, quote, "nothing in the business inconsistent with your sex." The idea of selling imported books was also a new one, and the audience was, of course, small. At the same time, Elizabeth was publishing a variety of books herself, as well as the transcendentalist magazine, The Dial. The second sister, Mary, actually spent more years as a teacher than Elizabeth did. She was often overshadowed by her talkative and brilliant sister. Both women were captivated by the romantic figure of the widowed Horace Mann who shared their boarding house in 1832. There was an intense, although barely admitted, rivalry for a number of years, during which Mann seemed perfectly content to have both women as confidants, especially as he continued to feel sorrow at the loss of his young wife. However, he finally settled his preference on Mary. Throughout a long courtship, engagement, and marriage, Mary worked with Mann on his career in politics and education and in the foundation of Antioch College. Many of Horace Mann's principles of education reform, such as eliminating flogging and rote learning, were the very ideals that Mary and Elizabeth had learned from their mother Eliza and practiced with success for years. Mary also wrote a book entitled Christianity in the Kitchen, which was a forerunner of the Boston Cooking School theories that later became famous. The sisters were often defined as having their particular roles, and they even defined themselves that way. Elizabeth was the learned one, or the leader. Mary was the beauty of the family, and Sophia was the artist. Sophia was also the invalid for much of her adult years. She suffered from migraines and other symptoms. Some of these could have been caused by medical practices of the day. For instance, as an infant, Sophia was not docile, and her parents assumed this was the result of teething. Therefore, they dosed her, as was the custom, with calomel, which contains high quantities of mercury and could have severely affected her nervous system. However, it was also true that Sophia's symptoms flared up whenever she felt too many demands were being put upon her or when things were not going her way. In the 19th century, people didn't speak of depression or anxiety disorders, but many families had invalids whose illnesses forced the household to revolve around them. Interestingly, once Sophia had married Hawthorne and left the family home, her health improved markedly. Elizabeth was actually the sister who befriended Nathaniel Hawthorne first. The two families had been neighbors early in their lives, and Elizabeth had communicated to Hawthorne how much she liked his stories. Hawthorne visited Elizabeth for about 6 months while Sophia the invalid remained upstairs in her bedroom. According to Marshall, there was an understanding between Elizabeth and Nathaniel, but once Sophia entered the picture, things changed, and Elizabeth abruptly announced her decision to move away to live with her brother in another town. Elizabeth never changed her opinion of Hawthorne's genius, publishing several of his works, including one illustrated by Sophia. Through the sisters, Hawthorne became so much a part of the Transcendentalist community that he planned to start married life with Sophia as members of the cooperative Brook Farm, being started by George Ripley. There were several experiments at this time in communal living. Alcott had had another one. Elizabeth was a big promoter of this and had written very praiseworthy articles in the Dial. The commune had noble goals of allowing members to cultivate the inner worth and depth in the individual soul and to love and assist each other as Jesus would have wished. In reality, Hawthorne found himself shoveling manure and developing blisters from raking hay, which interfered with his writing. And you can imagine, there were a number of people who felt they were very knowledgeable, people with large egos all trying to live together in this commune, most of whom did not know very much about farming. So Hawthorne did not stay with that community, and Sophia did not move there. The communal life may have been especially hard on Hawthorne, since he had grown up almost as much of a recluse as Sophia. He had a very bizarre family life, which may have influenced some of his writings. Instead of living in Brook Farm, the Hawthornes became neighbors of Emerson. Emerson had never really favored the commune idea. He wrote, "Those of us who do not believe in communities believe in neighborhoods." He encouraged his friends and acquaintances to move nearby, which the Hawthornes did. At this time, Elizabeth, deprived of the company of Mann and Hawthorne, turned to a new intellectual companion, a man 6 years younger than she, Reverend Theodore Parker. He was one of the greatest supporters of her bookshop, and he admired her sympathy, her intelligence, and her speech. Unlike Channing, he readily told her that she was a great influence for him, and said, "I shall get several sermons, as I have often done before now, out of Elizabeth's suggestions." As she had done with Channing, Alcott, and Emerson, Elizabeth became a staunch defender of Parker at the time of a controversy over his sermon in 1841, Discourse of the Transient and Permanent in Christianity. Now, I think that Ralph must be channeling Theodore Parker, because next week he's speaking on the transient and the permanent. Parker shocked even the Unitarian ministers by asserting that belief in the literal truth of Christ's miracles was irrelevant to Christian faith. Elizabeth wrote a long article in support of this sermon, saying, "If the Unitarian sect had known what it was about, if it had not forgotten entirely the ideas in which it originated, it would have embraced Mr. Parker as its last hope and supported him in his statements." Again, no one would print this article for a whole year. Well, Elizabeth had twice seen the men she admired usurped by her sisters, and within a few years, both Mary and Sophia were to enter happy marriages and have 3 children apiece. Sophia and Nathaniel were married for 22 years, and she, the invalid, survived him for another 7 years, dying at age 61. Mary lived to be 80 years old, carrying on Horace Mann's work. when he died 18 years into their marriage. He was considerably older. Perhaps Elizabeth was too powerful to be the womanly consort that most 19th century men desired. For example, Emerson, who really enjoyed the company of people like Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody, married a more domestic type. And I had not realized that before. I noticed she had this unusual name of Lydian. Well, it actually was Lydia, but Emerson thought that was too ordinary, so he changed it. There was an interesting discussion that took place between Elizabeth and Margaret Fuller about the issue of marriage, and this is from Marshall's book. Elizabeth had taken notes on one of Margaret Fuller's conversations, these were the discussion groups, in which the participants grappled with the question of why women failed to produce works of artistic genius. Was it because at the period of life when men gave themselves to such pursuits, most women became mothers? Then what of the women who didn't marry? Why weren't they more productive? The two most accomplished single women present, Peabody and Fuller, sparred over the question. Elizabeth offered the opinion that single women too often spent the rest of their lives in mourning over lost opportunities to marry. Society spoke so uniformly of women as more respectable for being married that it was long before she entirely despaired. So that sounds as if Elizabeth still hoped or regretted. Fuller snapped back that there came a time, however, when everyone must give up. Well, Margaret Fuller had had the experience of having several men express interest in her, and as things developed, they got frightened, rushed off, and married someone else. The irony, though, is that Margaret, who had given up, found herself married and a mother in a whirlwind love affair in Italy, while Elizabeth remained single all her 90 years. It was through her ability to read German that Elizabeth had learned of the theories of educator Friedrich Froebel. Froebel emphasized developing children's innate curiosity and teaching with kindness and creativity, as Elizabeth had been doing for years. And of course, it was from Germany that the idea of kindergarten originated. Elizabeth was particularly interested in establishing kindergartens in impoverished neighborhoods. She raised funds, traveled and lectured widely, and she even started programs to train the new kindergarten teachers. Mary and Horace supported her, and Mary contributed to her journal, The Kindergarten Messenger. The sisters had always been in favor of abolition and women's rights, and later joined reform groups for women's suffrage and Native American rights. Sometimes their altruism was taken advantage of. For instance, Mary and Elizabeth raised money for a Native American woman who called herself Princess Sarah Winnemucca, supposedly to build schools for her people. But at the end of 6 years, there was little to show for the effort, and the princess was not able to account for the funds. Still, the sisters always maintained their Unitarian belief in the essential goodness of human beings and the perfectibility of society. In summing up, I'm reminded of the saying, Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in high heels. Well, there was some of that going on here, too. The Peabody sisters, without money, position, or university degrees, held their own with and even set the direction for some of the most influential men of their day. Now, we do have time. I'm certainly not an expert on these. This is just an introduction, but I'd be happy to hear from you.
I was wondering what the child labor laws were at the time of the kindergarten being started. Did all kids get a chance to go?
Oh, yeah, I don't know much about that. Maybe someone else here knows more about that, how the kindergartens influenced the child labor movement. Certainly at the early part of the 19th century, there was plenty of child labor going on, and only some children were going to school. And there were fees for most schools as well. There were fees for Bronson Alcott School. It was not a free school. And most of the United States was still agrarian, and there were no schools available to many children.
Does Thoreau show up in these lives?
That's a good question. He was part of the same circle, and kind of peripherally, Thoreau was definitely part of the whole Emerson circle. There wasn't as much contact. He was a little bit younger than the sisters, but definitely they were all aware of each other's activities, and they were part of that circle that clustered around Emerson.
I became very interested in Elizabeth Peabody when I was doing research on Kate Douglas Wiggin, who is the author of Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. And it turns out that Wiggin met Peabody and in fact attended the first week of the Concord School of Philosophy, which Bronson Alcott had started and which Emerson attended and other luminaries from the area, from Concord. And in some of my research, I have tried to connect some of the kindergarten ideas of Froebel that were transmitted through Peabody and then into Wiggin into the development of American children's literature in the early 20th century.
So we could have a follow-up presentation. Because really, what Elizabeth Peabody is known for was really later in her life. This book and the research that I did was mainly on the earlier part of their lives. And I just wanted to make clear that the reason that I've focused on these men is because they're well known to us as Unitarians. And certainly not that that was how the women should be defined by the men in their lives, but it's an interesting connection for us to see how much influence the women had on them.
Rose and I were both students of and advised by Ralph Waldo Emerson in Berkeley, California in the 1940s and 50s. He only admitted that he was a relative of Ralph Waldo Emerson after several years. Close. But he was one of the most wonderful people we ever met. He certainly carried on the legacy of the Emerson. He was a distant, a very distant relative, actually, but happened to have the same name.
About child labor laws, I just finished reading 20 Years at Hull House, and Jane Addams was certainly very involved in getting child labor laws enacted, but there weren't any when she established Hull House.
What was the response of men in that period to see these women with all these ideas?
Within the transcendentalist circle, it seemed that they were well received, although I do think that Emerson was always a top dog. He took all these ideas. But the fact that they discussed them, or for instance, Channing really discussed a lot of these ideas with Elizabeth and later Parker, that they had really respect for them intellectually. Now, this was a somewhat rarefied circle in Boston. And I did not get a lot of information here, but it seems to me with the circumstances that these women were in, they could not have had much household help, if any. So besides everything they were doing, learning all these languages, someone still had to take care of the household, which at that time, this involved boiling water to wash clothes and baking bread and making soap and all these things, and there would have been no one else to do that. Tending the sick, there are a lot more things that were going on. They had a brother who also had a terminal illness, and all this was happening within the family, so it's just astounding how they were able to do.
Well, I'm wondering two things. I know you said they had brothers. The first thing, how many brothers did they have, and where did they fall in the family?
Yeah, there were three brothers, and they were all younger. Yes, the three sisters were born first, and then there were three brothers.
Okay, and the second question, I think you read something that Elizabeth wrote, but I'm wondering if you have another quote or something so we can just get a flavor of her style.
Yeah, I guess I don't have something. It was called Crossing, right? Any other historians here that, where somehow you would write it and then turn it 90 degrees and write kind of over it and, yeah. So I'll look for something. Maybe I could put something in the Prairie Fire.
That works better if you have two colors of ink.
Oh, they might have done that. I don't know.
I was thinking probably most of the women here and maybe some of the men have read Little Women, which is not just a child's book. And I was thinking that the character of Jo probably reflected in many ways aspects of these women at various times in their lives, because she's struggling to what we call now be her own person. She catches a lot of flack for being different from girls of her time from being athletic, from being boyish, from not liking skirts, from running instead of walking. And her first romance, as it were, was something that she handled very awkwardly because she didn't have an ounce of flirtatiousness in her. And it strikes me because she was so different from girls of her time and because she was also quite different from her sisters, that this is a very pointed portrayal of perhaps the sort of woman that these women might have envisioned as the next generation and so on. And Jo herself becomes a person who runs a school for children, while it's for boys, because she loved little boys, she has a couple of girls go through the school, and it's very interesting in the follow-up to Little Women to see her ideas and attitudes about the bringing up of girls. So we really get three generations in there, and I would bet a good deal that they reflect a lot of what these women thought and were talking about, and their ideas of education, and the women they would have been had they not been behind the men.
Yeah, and there certainly is a lot of autobiography in Louise May Alcott. I don't know if anyone's ever given a presentation on her. That would be another talk. But I actually have a great... I have a great quote, actually, that I was going to put in here, because in Little Women, the father is very respectable, and most of the time he's gone to the war. But really, Bronson Alcott was a hippie. He was a wild-eyed radical, and he kept coming up with all these ideas, and the poor family then had to cope and try to live. And I found a quote when I was looking for good opening and closing words, and it didn't quite fit, but now I can put it in, that Louisa May Alcott said, "My definition of a philosopher is of a man up in a balloon with his family and friends holding the ropes which confine him to earth and trying to haul him down." So it's something about what it would be like to actually be in the family of one of these geniuses, and you can see that with a number of people in different walks of life, how difficult it might be to actually live with someone like that.
I was going to recommend, if anyone hasn't read the novel March by Geraldine Brooks, it's Little Women told from the viewpoint of, regarding the father and his idealism and how the family almost starved to death in order to support his intellectual life and his idealism. And it's a real eye-opener because you realize that the only reason these men could have these philosophies and decide to go off in a commune and or to write something or to take a year and do something really radical was because of the women who not only supported them intellectually but kept the home fires literally burning and fed the children.
And Brooks is a Unitarian.
Oh, Geraldine Brooks is?
Oh, yeah.
Robin, I wanted to check out a piece of trivia that I picked up. was it Margaret Fuller who said that she would rather grasp the limb of a tree than the arm of Henry David Thoreau?
I don't remember that one, so there must have been another.
I see.
Because Margaret Fuller, I've done a lot of reading on it. I haven't run into that, but could be.
I don't know. Picked it up somewhere.
Well, there are some other things too where Hawthorne put a nasty portrayal of Margaret Fuller as one of his characters, and then Henry James apparently has a character who's based on Elizabeth Palmer, who's not Elizabeth Peabody, who's not very attractive. So there's that whole side of the writers using people they knew in their books.
Time for our offertory, and just a reminder that prayer needs all of our time and attention and intellect and emotion, and this is the financial bit. So please pass the baskets to one of the ushers. Thank you. Thank you. It's time for us to invite guests or visitors to introduce themselves. If you are coming to Prairie for the first or second time, or it's been a while since you've been here, we'd appreciate it if you'd introduce yourself and just tell us what brought you here.
I'm Kurt. My sons and I have been coming here for years. Oops. We left for a while, and we found out we missed this place much more than we thought we would.
And we miss them. Anyone else? Okay. And Prairie announcements. I'd like to start this one. First, just a reminder that you do have announcements in your order of service. Please look at those. Most of you are aware that we have been working hard to get a calendar together for our strategic planning process. And in the Prairie Fire today, or yesterday, I guess, came out a calendar that lines up the entire schedule and looks kind of densely packed, but the three most important ones for you to pay attention to are the actual congregational planning retreat days. So please look at the Prairie Fire, and also I'll be sending something out on Prairie News. We have a glitch, hopefully it's a small one, but our consultant who's going to be helping facilitate those sessions, whose name is Dan Weissman, is on the minister search committee in his church, and they have a very packed schedule. And he has actually twice now said, oh, that first date won't work for me, we now have a minister candidate. So we had currently scheduled for that day, our first 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday congregational planning session to be February 16th. He can't do it. And he wants to know if there's any way we could do this on the 23rd, and he's promised me an ironclad guarantee, unless he gets a deathly illness, that he won't have to change it again. We are tentatively planning that change, but this just happened, so I'm still in the process of touching base with everybody on the Strategic Planning Task Force, and I'll be talking with the board about that today to make sure this date will work for everybody. It looks like the calendar's clear. So everything else on the calendar is going to be right, but tentatively pencil in the 23rd instead of the 16th, and hopefully we'll be able to get word out to you by the email and also by any other methods we have to confirm that date, because it's, you know, it's only 5 weeks away, so we want to make sure you have that on your calendar.
Well, my husband is also capable of doing great things with a little encouragement. And one of them you can see next Sunday. He has put together a musical comedy that will be performed at the Chili Luncheon. I know many of you are going to be coming because you're in it. And he's working with Delita, who is our musical director. The name of it is Scrooge. The name of the play is Scrooge, Can You Spare Us a Pledge? And I think if you have not been recruited to sing and you're dying to sing in this play, let either Andy or Delita know. But we will have chili, both vegetarian and meat, and we hope that we'll see all of you next Sunday.
This is the beginning of our pledge. Unfortunately, I looked over the people who are appearing. We have more people appearing in this play than there are in the fellowship.
I just wanted to remind you that the day after the new proposed date for the strategic planning session is the service auction. There are a number of you who have not yet fulfilled your pledges. And so if you owe somebody something from the service auction, or if you are owed something, it's up to both parties to make good on the promise. And so I encourage you to do that. Also, I wanted to mention that you should be thinking about what you'd like to donate to the service auction, which is not only a way to support Prairie, but because of some of the social events involved, it's a great way to get to know people at Prairie. So who's going to be collect? Mary is going to be
collecting. Yes, if you have an idea of what you want to donate, just let me know. I'll be sending out an email
It can be breakfast in bed, or it can be a bike ride, or it can be, I don't know, a meal. It can be babysitting. It can be washing windows. Anything you can think of that would be of service. If you want a service, let me know, too, because maybe we can recruit someone to provide it.
Just a little change in the Prairie Elders meeting. We meet at 1:30 to 3:30 instead of 2 to 4.
Susan Hagstrom, who's giving the program next week, just got back from Manhattan. Oh, she's there. Did you want to give your own announcement? Sorry. And spending time in a library looking up things about Yip Harburg. And I spent time this morning probably flogging the choir. My apologies to the choir if you felt flogged. And anyhow, it promises to be a very, very interesting service next week. So you're going to get a good dose of music next week. And a whole lot of people owe me a massage afterwards.
Yes, I was going to say in advance that not only is she doing 98% of the accompaniment for the program, she is the music director for the pledge drive afterwards. So I think everybody should give her a clap in advance.
Due to a glitch on the calendar for Prairie, we're going to skip the movie group this month. Next month, we will be watching The Remains of the Day. Please look for the date. It'll be on a Thursday late in the month in the newsletter.
Have we covered it? Okay. Then we get to move to our final hymn, hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth.
Our closing words are from Theodore Parker. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living.
And please join us for fellowship.